A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave, medium wave, internet and satellite, this is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Media Network Historical Special, a profile of radio's infamous past, presented by Diana Janse and Jonathan Marks.
Six months ago, we took you on a tour of a special exhibition being held in the Netherlands Broadcasting Museum on the south side of Hilversum.
The great thing about the museum is that part of the collection always changes. The popular exhibition about offshore radio, which we covered last year, has now made way for an equally fascinating portrait of wartime radio. It covers the period of German Nazi occupation, starting on May the 10th, 1940, when German troops crossed the Dutch border.
The exhibition looks at the powerful influence that radio had and the way it was used by the Germans and the Allies to persuade. As you walk through the museum, there are headphones attached to many of the glass cabinets, and they bring the past to life.
Arno Weltens has designed the exhibition, and he started our tour by explaining that after the bombing of Rotterdam on May the 14th, 1940, and the capitulation of Dutch forces hours afterwards, a German infantry patrol headed for the center of Dutch broadcasting on Wednesday the 15th.
On the same day, a propaganda company of the Germans entered Hilversum, and they were looking for the studios. And here on the photographs you see that they ask a police officer the way to the Avro studio.
So they actually didn't know the way.
Of course there were information about the situation in Holland. There were spies who informed the German intelligence about several important objects. And the radio facilities, of course, was one of the main objects for the Germans to get a grip on.
The nice thing about this exhibition is not only visual, but there's also sound involved, especially as we're talking about radio. And let me grab one of the pair of headphones here. May 1940, ANP stories.
Het algemeen hoofdkwartier deelde ons hedenochtend om 4:15 het volgende mede. Van 3 uur af hebben Duitse troepen de grens overschreden.
The radio news from the Dutch press agency, ANP, reflects the somber mood and the surprise. Holland was neutral during the First World War and expected to keep out of this conflict too. A German army unit called the Holzhammer, the wooden hammer, simply marched in and took control of the media. Then, like now, Holland's domestic broadcasting system was run by several organizations. For instance, the VARA, representing the Socialists, the KRO for the Catholics, the NCRV and the VPRO for the Protestants, and the AVRO for the Liberals. The Germans took over the lot.
The whole broadcasting system, yes. And they were a bit surprised that nearly all the facilities were intact when they arrived.
They expected people to destroy it?
Yes, of course.
And as a radio listener at that time, what did you notice?
I know from talks I had with several other peoples and from the literature which is about this period. For instance, the well-known book from Dick Verkijk about Radio Hilversum during the occupation. That after the capitulation, if you turn on the radio, you couldn't hear anything. Just ticking, a clock ticking. It lasted about 2 days. And afterwards, the AVRO started at first with their programs under censorship, and that's very important.
Who's Antoine Dubois?
Antoine Dubois is a very important broadcast pioneer. He was the former director of the Nederlandse Seintoestellenfabriek, the NSF, which was also here in Hilversum. And in 1935, he became director of the NOSEMA, was the owner of the transmitters in Holland. And because he was well known also in international radio circles, the Germans, they asked him whether or not he was ready for taking over a job to get rid of the old radio organizations like AVRO, KARO, VPRO, and the NCRV.
And he did that?
He did that, yes. At first he said it's okay, but there are only a few restrictions. He said at first no propaganda for the Nazis and no personal attacks upon people of the royal family.
Queen Wilhelmina and the rest of the royal family escaped to Britain, and later some went into forced exile in Canada. After the war, Dubois was pardoned for his role as head of the broadcasting service. His defense was that he was just doing a job and hadn't collaborated, even though his demand that the Germans not use Dutch radio for propaganda seems rather naive with hindsight. On the 15th of December 1940, Dubois called broadcasting personnel together to call for unity.
Ik behoef u wel niet te zeggen, u hebt dat allemaal in de afgelopen tijden ruimschoots kunnen meemaken, hoe moeilijkheden en gevaren ons samenbinden, ons dwingen om op te geven.
He didn't remain head of Dutch broadcasting for long, though.
No, till March of 1941. But one of the things he also provided was a financial compensation for Jewish people who were at that time involved with Dutch broadcasting.
Wie heeft er suiker in de erwtensoep gedaan? Wie heeft dat gedaan? Wie heeft dat gedaan? De hele compagnie die heeft het eten laten staan. Wie heeft er suiker in de erwtensoep gedaan?
How quickly did German censorship take a hold? Was it quick?
It was quick. You can see here, for instance, a manuscript of a lecture from a person called Jan Veit about the subject workers in Holland from the 19th of November 1940. This manuscript had to be given to an organization called the Rundfunk Betreuungsstelle.
Right, so in other words, they could censor it, and they did it with a red pencil.
They did it with a red pencil, yes. And here it says abgelehnt, which means that it was forbidden to go on the air. There were also other limitations. For instance, here we have some old records, 78 opium records, from Jewish musicians. And it has a little label on it, which says it was forbidden to play them.
So the Down and Out Blues by Lou Stone and his band, forbidden. His Majesty the Baby by Elsa Carlisle. And I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm by Ambrose and his orchestra, all forbidden records.
Not only records. We have here a sort of list of the library, which was used by personnel, by staff of the Nederlandse Omroep. And if you look exactly at this page, you see, for instance, that the books written by Herman Heijermans, there was a little sign after the name of the title of the work, and it wasn't allowed to lend it out, this material.
So anything with a Jewish connection was immediately forbidden?
Was immediately forbidden. But not only for Jewish people. As the war goes on, at first there was a pact between Germany and Russia, between Stalin and Hitler. But then in the summer of 1941, Hitler decided also to occupy Russia. And as soon as this happens, for instance, here you see a paper from the Nederlandse Omroep, and it's addressed to Hugo de Groot. He was a very famous director. And there's a little line at the end of the marked, also with red pencil, that would you be so kind not to put any music of Russian composers on the air?
And that wasn't a subtle request, that was an order.
That was an order, yes.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the North Sea, the BBC had anticipated the German invasion of the Netherlands. Around a month before, on April the 15th, 1940, the BBC's Dutch service opened and immediately drew attention to the Nazi threat.
Here is London. U hoort thans onze dagelijkse nieuwsberichten in het Nederlands. Aan den oever van de Rijn hebben de Duitsers vandaag borden opgesteld waarop te lezen viel: Waar zijn de Engelsen? Het antwoord van de Fransen was...
Vraag dat maar aan admiraal Reeder.
In this case, the BBC anticipated that something might happen because they started Dutch language broadcasts before the invasion.
Yeah, that's true. And it was done by several people who were at that time in England. But I have to be very specific about the role of all these independent stations in England. They were also under censorship. So there was not only censorship in Holland under the Nazi regime, but there was also censorship in England. They had to hand over their text also to the English authorities, and was also censored by a red pencil.
In case what? That they might give away tactical information?
Yeah.
During the war, there were three Dutch programs put out over BBC transmitters. The British Broadcasting Corporation had its own Dutch service, but the British also gave short blocks of airtime to the Dutch government in exile.
Hier, Radio Oranje, de stem van strijdend Nederland. Op golflengte 1500, 373 en 261 meter. En in de 49, 31 en 25 meter band. Goedenavond, luisteraars in Nederland, in oost en west, op zee of waar ook ter wereld.
On the 28th of July 1940, Radio Orange, the voice of the Dutch government, took to the airwaves. A year later, a journalist, Henk van den Broek, started a program called the Brandaris, named after a famous Dutch lighthouse. Although it became a popular program in occupied Holland, it was actually aimed at Dutchmen elsewhere.
There were about 13,000 seamen, Dutch seamen, when the Germans captured Holland.
They were at sea?
They were at sea. So I thought that might be a nice idea to start a program for these people. The language he spoke was totally different. And there was another man involved, not only Henk van den Broek, but a very famous writer, A. den Dolaert. And they used a sort of synonym. They called themselves Bob and the Rotterdammer, because they were afraid for reprisals.
Against their family, I guess.
Against their family, yes.
So, and again, the language that they were using wasn't very much the sort of presentation language that was famous within the BBC. In other words, very upper class. But this was very much working class, I guess.
Yes, this was working class, yeah.
There was a fourth and clandestine broadcast in Dutch, originating from British soil. But few people in Holland realised that a short and highly patriotic broadcast on shortwave, repeated several times a day, didn't come from an underground hideout in occupied Holland. It was part of a highly secret British disinformation campaign run from Woburn Abbey in central England. Archives at the Imperial War Museum in London reveal that the Flitspout was one of several clandestine stations aimed at occupied Europe.
The BBC is British, and even to the Allies, it's John Bull talking, and of course talking his book. Now, as long as his advice and instructions suit the listener's book as well, the listener will readily carry them out. But you're apt to lose his confidence if you tell him from your armchair in London to undertake grave risks or to destroy his livelihood and starve in England's interest. But suffer they must for victory, and shortage and ruin and chaos and riots in Europe are part and parcel of it. The more of them, and the sooner they come, the sooner will Germany be beaten. Now, the essential quality of the Freedom broadcaster is that to the ordinary listeners, he speaks from inside their country. He is one of them, and has the right to send them wrecking trains or cutting throats if they will. For rumours of shortage cause hoarding, and so create shortage.
The technical department are the disillusionists of the peace. We must dispel illusions of gramophone records smuggled to lonely cottages in the Ardennes, of transmitters and disguised motor vans, or hidden in the forests of Central Europe. Although we know of official declarations by German authorities that these transmitters have actually been located, the operators arrested and executed, the sober truth is that the Freedom Station transmitters are three special radio stations near this house. One may be seen 2 miles from here on the right of the road to London.
Maak het donker in het donker. Ook al gaan de sterren door met een geklonker.
Ik loop langs de ijzerkant met mijn luchtbeschermingsband, de lantaarn in mijn hand, om te kijken waar iets brandt. Ouders rekening met.
Before the war, each Dutch broadcasting company had its own program schedule for members. But the Germans quickly banned these separate publications and issued their own.
They said there was a shortage of paper, so that's the way they explained it to the people. But they didn't want to have all these separate program schedules. They just wanted one under their own censorship.
Right, and of course there wasn't any television at that time. Any television experiments happening in the UK had immediately stopped because of the war. So indeed it was a listening guide, as it was, the Luisterkids. But naturally, of course, it didn't tell them about the Dutch language broadcast on the BBC.
No, of course. No.
The Broadcasting Museum has tried to portray the contrasts in lifestyle between the Dutch National Socialists and ordinary Catholic and Protestant families. They've reconstructed a living room of the period, but it's split down the middle by a red, white and blue ribbon.
They used, for instance, just one radio, but the National Socialists, they were listening to their leader, Mussert, while the Catholic or the Protestant family were preferring the voice of Queen Wilhelmina. They used different papers, and you see them here on the table. There is Volk en Vaderland on one side, and there is the Maasbode on the other side. There is a calendar from the National Socialist Movement on the one side, and on the other side there's one of the KRO.
Inside a glass cabinet is a photo of the Dutch royal family, dropped out of RAF planes for Allied propaganda purposes. German-controlled Dutch radio warned its listeners that these photos were covered in phosphorus, which could burn your hands if you tried to pick them up.
I also explained here, for instance, that the people on the, on the wrong side, they had better food and they could easily buy things, and the other ones had to do it with coupons.
Okay, and what have we got behind here? These toys?
In this glass cabinet and the panel, you see photos of everyday life in Holland, and especially in Hilversum. For instance, occupation of Grand Hotel Gooiland. And if you look carefully at the photo, you see two German people outside with armed people outside the entrance.
Right in the centre of Hilversum, of course, you've got the town hall, and that was designed by a famous architect, Dudok. But during the war, it was camouflaged.
Yeah, the tower was camouflaged, not to give the RAF planes a recognition point to throw their bombs on the headquarters of Blaskowitz, which was also here in Hilversum.
What was that?
Blaskowitz was, there was a bunker, the headquarters of the Luftwaffe here in Holland.
And likewise, too, the studios of the Avro, one of the broadcasters, was also pretty nearby.
Yeah.
In previous media networks, we've covered the work of Radio Orange, or Radio Orania, which started on the 28th of July 1940. It was, in fact, the voice of the Dutch government in exile. Now, you've got some rather interesting mementos here, including a rubber stamp and what looks like a huge microphone.
Yes, this is a Marconi ribbon microphone, which was used at that time for Radio Orange. And there's a picture next to it, and it shows Queen Wilhelmina speaking in front of the microphone.
And also, this is rather important, a medium-wave loop antenna. That was necessary because the Germans were jamming the broadcasts.
Yes, and we rebuilt this model from paper, which was also thrown out by RAF planes. They said if you use this circuit diagram, you could listen to England.
Now, they call it the Moffensafe, which if I translate means, the German sieve.
Well, that's Moff. It's the same like the English use kraut for a German.
So it's not very complimentary.
No.
Right, now to programming. What happened as far as the programmes on Dutch radio were concerned?
Well, if you look at the percentage, for instance, it says here, this is an advertisement from the Nazi broadcast, the Nederlandse Omroep. And if you look at it carefully, you see that 71% is music.
So there wasn't much talk.
It was mainly entertainment. And that's why Dutch people were listening to the radio. There were two different directions in propaganda. There was one line, which was the line of Hitler, and it said it had to be very bombastic, with a loud voice and things like that. And
a bit then, like Wagner.
Like Wagner. And then you had the other line, which was more the line of the propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. And he said it had to be very subtle. And that's the way they had to do it. So you had, of course, some programs in which you could easily hear the ideology of the National Socialists. For instance, a quarter hour broadcast from the SS or the NSB. But people knew when they were listening to it that it was propaganda. And they put out the radio or they didn't listen to it. And they waited until the program for the women or for children came on later.
But as, for example, Jewish Solis disappeared from the radio, other programs came to take their place. For example, the morning gymnastics.
I was amazed when I found out that this program, which was very popular during the 50s and 60s, was actually introduced by the Germans, because before the occupations, there wasn't a program like that.
Which, of course, was part of the ideology, wasn't it?
Yes, it had something to do with the German ideology of a healthy mind in a healthy body.
Now, while the music, also of American and English composers and likewise performers, disappeared, there were other programs that the Germans thought were very important, for example, programs for farmers, and also sport continued as normal.
Yeah. Here there's a photograph of a cyclist called Arie van Vliet, and he's interviewed by Karel Noord, who was later a very important person with the broadcast.
And also the reportages outside the studio. I noticed that the outside broadcast van is running on gas.
Yes, it was on gas because there was a shortage of petrol.
In 1941, a committed National Socialist took over Dutch radio under German control.
That's true. That was Willem Herwijer. He was the Director General of the Nederlandse Omroep. He was a very convinced National Socialist, but he was also, in spite of his political views, he treated the people, I mean the personnel of the Nederlandse Omroep, very well. And even after the war, because he fled to Switzerland, because he was married to a Swiss woman, there wasn't any complaint about him brought out. For instance, that's a very famous story. If he heard, for instance, that some of the people in a studio put on the Radio Orange to listen to, he said, well, I guess this is the wrong station.
There were no repercussions as
a result. There were no repercussions. There was a story about Mr. Goldschmeding. He was listening to this to Radio Orange, and not only listening to it, but he also talked about it with several other people about the news. He was arrested, and he was put in prison for 3 months. And afterwards, Herwijer just took him on his stuff, so there was no problem.
But this idea of mixing the hard propaganda with, let's say, the subtle propaganda of entertainment obviously didn't work, because in the middle of May 1943, the Germans ordered people to actually hand over their radios.
Yeah, that's true. There were some pamphlets. It depended whether or not you were staying in a village or in a large city like Rotterdam or Amsterdam, because that took several weeks to collect all the radios. To give you some idea, at that time there were about 800,000 radios. And the Germans knew this exact figure, because in 1941 they introduced the Luistervergunning,
which translates as the license fee. The 200,000 members of the Dutch National Socialist Party, the NSB, could keep their radios for a little time longer. Others, though, had to hand them in to be sent to other parts of the German Reich.
But some of them dropped them at first, so they didn't. They thought, well, so they couldn't send it to Germany, for instance. Or if they had bought radio on a later date, because radio started here, as you know, in 1919, so they could easily be more radios in home, they handed in their old-fashioned model.
I see. And what happened to the radios? They were destroyed?
No, they just put them in storage.
Did people get them back after the war?
Only a few.
After the Germans collected radios in 1943, listening to broadcasts from London had to be done in secret. The museum has examples of miniature radios built inside books and cigar tins. They are ingenious pieces of improvised engineering, bearing in mind there were no transistors. You needed valves or tubes to make a radio, and you often had to generate high voltage to make them work. But what happened if you got caught?
Well, here, for instance, you can see it on this document. It's a strafbevel, which says that someone in Nijmegen, he was condemned for 3 months imprisonment for illegal possession of a radio.
And a little bit later on, in fact, it was even stronger, because there was a story here that you could be sentenced for up to 2 years of hard labour for listening.
Yeah, that's true.
After the summer of 1943, you also see that a lot of illegal newspapers were being printed in lofts and attics and in cellars in the Netherlands. I guess the radio was pretty important too, in terms of getting the information.
Yeah, because before the time, as already explained, you see that you could easily listen to the programs of Radio Bandaris, of the Dutch section of the BBC, of Radio Orange. But afterwards, it wasn't possible. And then, at that time, people were listening to illegally listening to the radio. They used a typewriter for the news. Then it was stenciled, and the papers were handed out. And it was, of course, a very dangerous job to do it, because if you get caught, you might end up in prison, or even worse things could happen to you.
But at a later stage, even the 200,000 radios owned by the Dutch Nazis, they were also confiscated, and they had to be modified.
Yeah, they used the term sterilization of radios for that.
That means to say they made the shortwave inactive.
Yes.
One of the highlights of the exhibition is a large black box, which turns out to be a groundwave jamming unit. These were installed in many Dutch cities and were designed to block resistance broadcasts coming from London. Basically, each of these units was a 1.2 kilowatt radio station designed to broadcast noise. The exhibition shows clearly the difference between black and white propaganda. The Germans use subtle means of persuasion as well as the obvious. You could learn German via courses on the radio, for instance, but the illustrations in the accompanying textbook reflected the superiority of the Aryan race and contained political cartoons degrading the Allies.
Part of the exhibition is devoted to the prominent Dutch propagandist Max Blokzijl. On the radio he gave talks in which he sounded rather like a wise old uncle.
Het is een zo groot geluk dat in zulke tijden een eerlijk en rechtschapen man als Mussert.
Yes, he was a correspondent, he was a journalist of the Algemeen Handelsblad in Berlin during the 30s, and he believed in the ideas about National Socialism, and he became a secret member of the National Socialist Movement in 1935, and in 1941 he was asked by the German authorities to come over, and he became head of the press of the Department of Volksvoorlichting and Kunsten.
In the early part of the war, Blokzijl succeeded in generating quite a listener's mail back, both for and against what he was saying.
He was arrested after the war. It's very interesting to know that even on the day of the capitulation of the German forces, on the 5th of May 1945, there was a transmission of one of his talks. And I guess there was no one listening anymore to his talks. There was no energy, there were no radios. So in a way it's a bit tragic.
Max Blokzijl was executed in Scheveningen prison in March 1946.
The exhibition at the Dutch Broadcasting Museum, called Radio in Oorlogstijd, or Radio During the War, runs until April 29th. And Diana, I think you'd agree it's well worth a visit.
What fascinated me was that the designers managed to give a good overview of what life was like in those days for ordinary people who were suddenly confronted by the invasion and had no idea how long it would last. It's interesting, too, that such an exhibition raises questions as well as answering them. For example, many books say that during the Second World War, shortwave broadcasts from Holland were suspended. But it seems that a shortwave transmitter with the call sign PCV was broadcasting from Kootwijk on around 18 megahertz in August of 1944. The program schedule of the KRO lists English programs, as well as news in Dutch, intended for listeners in the Dutch East Indies, that's now Indonesia.
But what's so strange about that?
Well, Dutch Nazi sympathizers were rounded up and interned in 1940, and soon afterwards they were sent to Suriname. When the Japanese arrived in Indonesia, they put the rest of the Dutch into camps. Even if those prisoners of war had access to a shortwave radio, it's rather unlikely they would be looking for Nazi entertainment out of Hilversum.
On May the 3rd, we'll trace the history of another milestone in Dutch broadcasting, namely Radio Horizon Nederland, the forerunner of Radio Netherlands, all part of a period when radio was the major weapon in the battle for hearts and minds.
And next week we'll be concentrating on the present again, in 6 days, 23 hours and 29 minutes from now.
Media Network Historical Special was produced and presented by Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen. Copyright 1995 AD.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.